come up on Taiwan.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. And I'm sure many of you have heard it already that poet Philip Levine has died. He is one of the most well-known poets in the English language. He was Poet Laureate of the United States. He was a Pulitzer Prize winner. We're going to replay an interview that Benjamin Alida Sines and I had with him a couple of years ago. My experience with Philip Levine is quite personal as well as professional. You know, as a writer, he's certainly one of the ones that we study. He knows the craft, and he is known as one of the best poetry teachers around. But he pretty much transformed my hometown, Fresno, California, when Philip Levine went to Fresno in the 50s to teach at what was then Fresno State College. He pretty much changed the literary landscape of poetry and brought a lot of poets to Fresno. And now there's just so many poets from Fresno. They're popping up all over the place. And I think in many ways, he's largely responsible for that. When I was the visiting writer at Fresno State, Philip Levine offered me his house while he was in Brooklyn for that semester. And so I was able to live in his house. But what I want to remember mostly is the day that he came back after 4 or 5 months in Brooklyn. The car pulls up. A friend of his picked him up at the airport. And he steps out of the car with a backpack, a tiny backpack, not much in it. And I said, "You want me to help you with your luggage?" And he goes, "This is my luggage." And I thought, how is it possible that he was gone for 4 or 5 months and that's all he needed to bring with him? And it really made me think, that's what a poet is. We don't carry around stuff. We just care about what's inside and what we can carry in our pockets or in our hearts. And I just try to live my life like that. That one small image of him was incredibly meaningful for me. It's not about what we carry. It's about what we have inside. So let's listen to this interview with me and Benjamin Alida Sines with the now deceased Philip Levine. Philip Levine is the author of over 20 books. Around 19 of them poetry and a collection of essays, a must-read for poets called The Bread of Time Towards an Autobiography. He was born in Detroit, and after a succession of industrial jobs, he left the city for good and lived in various parts of the country before settling in Fresno, where he taught at Fresno State until his retirement. For 12 years, he served as poet-in-residence at NYU, teaching graduate workshops in poetry. He has received many awards for his books, including the National Book Award in 1999 for What Work Is and the Pulitzer Prize in 1995 for The Simple Truth. In 2011, he was appointed Poet Laureate of the United States. He divides his time between Fresno, California, and Brooklyn, New York. We are honored to have Philip Levine on Words on a Wire. You said in an interview one time that when you were 18 years old, you went to New York for the first time, and you looked around, and you says, "I'm going to live here." And then you said it took you 50 years to do that, but that now you actually live part of the year in New York and part of the year in Fresno. Why was it so important for you to live in New York, and how does New York feed you differently from, say, Fresno?
I think it was important for me to get there just because I'd made that vow to myself. because, I mean, it could have been Seattle. It could have been, although Seattle, I know, New York, Chicago.
San Francisco.
Yeah. It's just that, it was the city of my awakening, what a city could be. At the age of 18, I'd spent my whole life in Detroit, and it had good side, it had its bad side. I mean, it was almost 2 million people when I turned 18 because the city grew enormously during the war because anybody in the world could get a job. And, there were three shifts up making war material for the Second World War. And then when the war ended, there was no manufacture for civilian vehicles during once we entered in 41. All that stopped. So there was this huge need for new cars, and there was a lot of money around. And so the city was prosperous, And, you know, the art museum was terrific, and they got all kinds of visiting shows. But there was no course in poetry writing at Wayne University, where I went. None. Their welcome to poetry consisted of a single reading in a year. And I knew about 12 other people who wrote poetry, because there was a little group that met in a room in the library of Wayne. A guy had died, a guy named Theodore Miles had died in World War II and willed his poetry collection. He was a friend of Berryman's and a fledgling poet. He willed it to the school, and they built this little room to house this. And about a dozen of us would meet once a month and talk about poetry and read each other's poetry. And we were excessively kind to each other. Well, I never heard anyone say that stinks, and yet a lot of what we presented stunk. But, you know, if you've only got 12 readers in the universe, you have to, you know, be nice to them.
Exactly.
And, you know, when I went to New York at 18, I went and saw Dylan Thomas. He was reading at the 92nd Street Y. I said, holy cow, this place. And then I think it was over on 2nd Avenue or 3rd Avenue, one of those avenues was just lined for several blocks with used bookstores.
Wow.
And I went hunting in there and finding stuff. At the time, I had discovered Faulkner. And at that time, when I was 18 years old, most of Faulkner was out of print. He hadn't gotten the Nobel Prize yet. He wasn't a huge selling... You know, he's a difficult writer, so... But it was very exciting to be able to go into these places. I wanted to buy a collected Thomas Hardy, and I found one for like a dollar and a half or something. You know, it was a wonderful trip. And I had a car. The reason I went at that moment was a guy paid me to drive his car to New York. He had a huge, beautiful convertible, and it was a woman he wanted to impress. But he was a rich guy. I worked for his family, tutoring his idiot younger brother. And he paid me to take the car. And then I had to take care of myself. And then, you know, like a week later, after he wined and dined this woman who rejected him, he flew back and I drove the car back. And I just had a hell of a good time.
We're talking to Phil Levine, Poet Laureate of the United States. Let me ask you a question. Did you always, always, always want to be a poet? It sounds like you did, like from the very beginning.
Yeah, I would say in my teens, it bit me. I'm trying to think of it. It's hard to say exactly when I turned to this need, you could say, because for me it was a need to write poetry.
Yeah.
And decided I wasn't going to be an amateur poet. I was going to be a real poet, whatever the hell the distinction is. You know, because, you know, the United States then, and to a large degree today, I think, you know, parents are not sitting there, gee, I hope Charlie goes and gets an MFA and makes a life for himself and writes poetry. I mean, you hear it when I taught at Fresno State, the first year I was here, I had a student. His name was Lawson Inada, a Japanese-American kid. His folks, he had been in prison, you know, he'd been put in one of the camps during the war. And his folks wanted him to be a dentist or a doctor, especially a doctor. His father was a dentist. All of, you know, the men in his family, even though they were professional men, they'd been put in a camp in Utah. Anyway, his mother called me. When I'd been here, it was getting near graduation. He was going to graduate. She asked me if I would talk to Lawson and dissuade him from following this ridiculous career in poetry. And I said to her, "No, that's not my job, Mrs. Bernard." I said, "You know, my job is to teach poetry. That's a parent's job, not mine." And she said, "Then you can't do this." I said, "No, I can't do this. He's 21 years old. He has to make his own choices." A couple years later, listen to this. She calls me up. By this time, Lawson's got an MFA, and he's got a teaching job in Oregon. And wow. She calls me up, and she says, Mr. Inada and I have decided that it's a good thing that that's a law. Because we thought about it, and the writing of poetry is an ancient and honorable profession. So all she had to do was change her vocabulary and concede that it was a profession, and it was fine. Yeah. But how many parents do that? So there was no great welcome. But in my case, no one discouraged me. No one discouraged. Hey, I was the first guy in my family to go to college or to complete two mm-hmm. semesters. My older brother started, but then he got drafted for the Second World War, and he never went back to college. And my mom was proud of me. Phil's going to college, you know. and she had harbored a desire to write. And she wrote song lyrics. And she was an avid reader, as had my father had been, too. My father died when I was very young. My grandfather, when he was sick and dying, Tom, I went back to see him in the hospital in Detroit. He said to me, I'm not going to leave you a dime. I'm giving it to your twin brother. I'm giving him the business. He had a little used car parts business. And he said, because if I gave you money, you would just waste it on poetry. When he first found out I wanted to be a poet, he asked me in Yiddish, "Darf mir gehen in college?" For this, you went to college? And I said, "Why do you say that? Why do you say that to me?" And he said, "Well, you know, when I lived in Russia, there was a poet in our village, and all he did was go from house to house and read his poetry, and then make your meal." You know. I said, "Oh, okay." I said, "It's a little different here. I'm not going around Detroit knocking on doors and saying, would you like to hear a poem?"
You know, the MFA community has grown tremendously since you went to Iowa and studied with John Berryman and had that incredible experience in the workshop. Now there's just hundreds of MFAs and thousands of graduates, and every single one of them is looking to get published, and they're looking to get a job. It's different now to want to be a poet. Would you still want to be a poet today if you were entering the poetry world the way it is now?
Yeah, I think I would. I don't know how I would do in it. I mean, because you're exactly right. I mean, the experience I had is absolutely foreign to young people. They don't know what I'm talking about. The other day I was talking to two students that I went to a poetry reading here in Fresno, and I was talking to a couple of students in the MFA program. Mm-hmm. And the world they were talking about, they were asking me similar questions, what it was like. They looked at me with puzzlement. And, of course, I went to Iowa when I was 26, but then there were a lot of young people today, I'm sure, who go when they're not kids either. But, it, you know, Iowa was the only game in town. And the only reason I went was to study with Robert Lowell. I mean, I thought, Robert Lowell is teaching? It was so, you know, exciting. I didn't go to get a degree. You know, I think I registered for a single class the first semester. Yeah, one class. And sat in on other classes. And the second semester, when I studied with Berryman, I wasn't even registered. I didn't have the money, so I didn't register. I just lied.
You kept saying it was an administrative error or something like that?
Berryman said, "No, Philip, I think it's anti-Semitism. They took your money and now they're screwing you."
Now, was it Berryman that drove you to the airport and said, "Give me four poems, send them to me," and then he was quite serious? Was it Berryman that did that?
Yeah, and he kept his word.
And teachers, poetry teachers, just don't have the time to do that anymore. They don't do that anymore. I mean, that attention you got was just incredible. And as a teacher, you're as known as well for your teaching as you are for your poetry. You're thought of really kind of in the same way, very old school way. Brian Turner tells us that he went into your class, wasn't registered, but you didn't care. You let him sit in.
He was talented. I mean, it was very clear he had a gift. So what did I give a shit? And I remember once when I was teaching at Columbia, I'm a friend of the novelist and essayist, Peter Matheson. Mm. And his wife had a secret desire to be a poet. And she asked if she could sit in on the class. And I said, sure. And my students, a couple of students, seeing her there every week, just sitting in the background. Sometimes she'd bring a friend. And they dressed very nicely. Neither of these two women had ever gone to college. So they didn't know the way people could go to college. There were students who were almost as old as she was. And one day she didn't come, and one of the students said that they didn't want her there. And I said, what do you mean? She's just sitting here, but there isn't enough oxygen or something. and they said, well, you know, it's against the rules. I said, well, it's a dumb rule, isn't it? If they're getting something out of this, well, what's the harm? They're not taking anything from you. I've never even seen a poem by her. And this one woman, who was the spokeswoman for all of them, there were about five of them, said, well, it's against the rules. I said, well, I'll tell you what. The dean is upstairs. Let's go up there and tell him what I'm doing. And if he's so vehemently opposed to it, he can fire me. And I told him, I said, John Berryman let me do this. And it was the most important class I had in my whole life. So you're not going to push me around like that. This is the way it's going to be. Take it or leave it. One of us is going to leave. And she said, well, we'll think about this. I said, go ahead. And nothing was ever said about it. But I saw there was a kind of, I don't know what the hell had happened in America, that in the creative writing thing where a friend can't come in and sit in the back of the room. You know, I got pissed off.
Yeah. And I do think that sometimes in poetry circles, unfortunately, it becomes this kind of elitist club that people think of it that way, and they're part of the club, and they don't, you know, they got let into the club somehow, and they don't want to let others in, and it's really disturbing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, when I went to this reading this last week, I sensed this, that there was the MFA cadre there, even at a dump like Fresno State. And you know, they should have had little epaulets or little eagles on their shoulders to indicate first year and second year. I remember going to giving a reading at West Point, and it was so stratified. I mean, the freshmen, for example, were called cows. Cows.
Cows.
Yeah, and the upperclassmen insulted them, and Franny and I had lunch with these folks, and it was just Franny and me and these cadets, and one of the cadets reached for something without asking permission. He was a cow, and he didn't say to the head guy, a senior, who had, like, stripes on his arm or something, said, you didn't ask if you could have that. And the guy's put it back. He said, yes, sir. May I have it, sir? Like this. Yes. You may have that. You may have that piece of bread, you cow. I thought, holy shit. Thing, you know?
And poetry can be like that, too. The poetry community, I imagine.
Yes. May I have that I am over there and put it in my poem? No, you may not.
That's right.
Let me ask you a question. What do you intend to do as poet laureate?
As little as possible. I'm serious. You know, at my age, also, so far, it has really cut into my writing, and that's probably why I'm going to give it up. I mean, I could have a second year at it, but somebody else can do it just as well or probably better. It's been fun, but I want to get back to my work. And, you know, you're a writer. You know what I'm talking about. We thrive in solitude and isolation at times, and that's where the best work comes out of. Maybe there are other writers who aren't that way. I don't know. You know, I see a poet like Gerald Stern who just loves to be in crowds, and you know, then he sneaks off in the corner and starts hammering away at a poem, and then he's back reading it to us. And Robert Bly was like that when he was young. But I'm not that kind of guy. I really, really still need to write. And, you know, it's my sense is it was what I'm supposed to be doing. You know, it's what I do. You know, even if it's bad, even if the writing is bad and it's more often not very good than it's very well done, it's what I have to do. So, you know, I've met an enormous amount of people, and I've read at a lot of diverse places. Some of them were fabulous. You know, I read for the AFL-CIO in their headquarters in Washington, D.C. I was invited to a writing club. This is incredible. In Harlem. So I go.
Mm.
It's made up of 11-year-old sixth-grade students, and they are so well-read. And they've all decided they want to be writers. And it was, you know, the Rainbow Coalition. Half of them were black. There were Puerto Rican kids there. There were Asian kids and white kids. And these very devoted teachers who were, they met once a week. And the teachers, there were two teachers who were involved in it. And they just contributed their time to these kids. And there was one grandmother of one of the kids. There was the local priest was there. It was an amazing, and the local poet, a guy who had an MFA from somewhere, I forget where, and he lived in the neighborhood. So it was just terrific. I was there for about an hour and a half talking to them about writing. And I ended by reading a poem, and they all cheered me and everything, and I thought, I never would have met these people and these wonderful teachers. It was a very exciting thing to do.
I have a question about growing up in Detroit, working in the auto industry when you were a young man and trying to write poems when you weren't at work. What kind of impact must it have been for you to see the Diego Rivera murals depicting the auto industry when you were working in the industry and trying also to express yourself poetically?
They were, and still are, you know, just an overwhelming artistic experience. And they had a double kind of impact on me. One was, this was the most significant piece of art on industrialized America. And it was made by a Mexican. So I was really stunned by that, and stunned by the visuals as well as the knowledge that a foreigner had come to our city, and his visit, by the way, was documented there. They had, you know, photographs and stuff you could see, you know, like a book that was chained up so you couldn't walk away with it. And so there was this double whammy. Who is this guy? And, of course, that led me to finding more of his work, you know, in books. And even seeing some of them. And then I discovered that he'd done this incredible thing in Rockefeller Center in New York, and they'd erased it because, I don't know, he put Trotsky in there or somebody. on the other hand, I didn't see it as a work of art. I also saw that in a curious way it did not represent work. It's so harmonious. And people move in it in such, you know, like a dance.
Yes, yes.
That it didn't look at all like the interior of a factory. It had many of the elements, but there was a beauty to it that was absent in the places where I worked. And all these people moving in concert, you know, it looked the way an opera might look about war. You know, everybody would come out and sing with the bombs going off in the back. Oh, sure, that's right. Yeah, let's sing about the loves we left back in Cleveland. You know, you can just imagine it. So it was both beautiful, but it took me a while to realize that it, even though it was inspiring and gorgeous, and he'd done an amazing thing, and he's obviously a fantastic artist, that in a way it wasn't something I could utilize in my own work, because that wasn't my experience. And it wasn't his either, because he never worked in a factory. But he did, you know, he went out to the Ford plant. He saw it again and again. And during the McCarthy period, there were people who wanted it erased. Can you imagine? They did. They did. Yeah. They wanted it covered up or removed or what have you. And then I went back to see it, oh, I don't know, it must be 25 years ago, after they cleaned it. And it was even more striking. It was just fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get in that room, it's, you know, it's like the Sistine Chapel of industrialism. I mean, it's an amazing work.
We're wondering if you'd be able to read a poem for us. We would love to hear anything that you would like to read, your new work, old work, anything.
Well, let's see.
We're talking to Phil Levine. Where are you right now, Phil? Are you in Fresno?
Yeah, I'm in Fresno. I'm in my the horrible pigsty where I write my poems. I mean, it's a mess here. Books and papers scattered. That's why I'm having such a hard time finding a poem.
And I had the privilege of writing in that room too. Most of my stories from Unending Rooms were written in that very, very chair. Listening to your jazz too.
Yeah, I'm going to read a poem. Did you ever know Ernesto Trejo?
Of course, yeah. Fresno poet, died very young.
Yeah, and he and I translated together a book of poetry by Jaime Sabines, Tarumba. Okay, this is called Llanto. It was written, a year after he died, and we knew how much we'd lost. Llanto for Ernesto Trejo. Plum, almond, cherry have come and gone. The wisteria has vanished in the dawn. The blackened roses rusting along the barbed wire fence explain how April passed so quickly into this hard wind that waited in the west. Ahead is summer, and the full sun riding at ease above the stunned town no longer yours. Brother, you are gone. That which was earth, gone back to earth. That which was human, scattered like rain into the darkened wild eyes of herbs that see it all. Into the valley oak that will not sing, that will not even talk. I wrote it in that form because I had translated some Machado that was written in the same form, and Ernesto loved the form. He just loved that movement, and he's gone, but I thought, I'm gonna write one for him.
It's a beautiful poem.
Thank you very much for joining us, Philip Levine. We were talking to Philip Levine, poet, Pulitzer Prize winner, and Poet Laureate of the United States. Thank you very much for joining us on Words on the Wire.
Thank you both.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Benjamin.
That was an interview with Philip Levine from March 2012. This year, we lost some very significant writers, Mark Strand, who was also on this show, Michelle Cerros, the Chicano poet, and now Philip Levine. I'm Daniel Chacon. Don't forget, the next book you read may save your life. I'm up on the tight wire.